Good morning. Two major Supreme Court rulings go Trump's way on immigration. NPR's Nina Totenberg tells us why the court appears more split than she's ever seen.
They can't seem to put the genie back in the bottle. It's only getting worse. And of course, at the end of the term, it's worse yet.
Search and rescue efforts continue after the Venezuelan earthquakes and the World Cup match that both sides want to lose. It's Friday, June 26th. I'm Gideon Resnick in for Shamita Basu. This is Apple News Today. Yesterday, the Supreme Court's conservative majority gave the Trump administration two powerful tools for its immigration agenda. Full authority to deport hundreds of thousands of migrants who have been living and working legally in the U.S. without intervention from the courts, and an avenue to block asylum seekers from entering the country. Joining me now to discuss these decisions is NPR's legal affairs correspondent, Nina Totenberg. So let's start with the case involving asylum seekers. The court ruled that the Trump administration can turn people away that are seeking asylum at the U.S.-Mexico border by physically preventing them from crossing into the U.S. So could you just walk us through how the justices reached this decision and then the practical impacts?
Well, it's going to make getting asylum much, much more difficult because up until now, for all practical purposes, if you thought you had a good asylum claim, you went to specially designated portals at the border and you said, I'm here, and they went through everything with you. Now, what the Trump administration has done is it's stationed people at the border to prevent anybody from filing an asylum claim. In order to do that, they would have to put their foot literally over the border. And if they can't get their foot over the border, they can't apply for asylum in the United States, which is what the system used to be and is no longer.
And within the ruling itself, there was a pretty blistering dissent from Justice Sotomayor, which she read aloud in court. That is a little bit unusual, but maybe even more unusual is Justice Alito kind of responding and saying, you know, he would have added more to his own if he knew that she was planning to read that. Can we just stop for a moment and talk about this moment and what it tells us about the relationship?
She wrote a very powerful dissent in which she invoked the Statue of Liberty essentially in tears. But Justice Alito, after she finished her dissent, and I have been covering the court for more years than I want to tell you, more decades than I want to tell you, I have never seen this happen. He said, well, if I had known that Justice Sotomayor was going to read her dissent from the bench, I would have said more in my statement from the bench. But it was such an example, I think, of a rather unhappy court at the moment, especially, you know, we'll have to attribute a lot of this to being the end of the term and everybody being very tired. But you also have to assume from this that this is not a happy group together. This is not nine people who get along well.
And when Americans see this, when they see disagreement and dissent kind of spill over into what sometimes seems like almost animosity, why is it important that there is some level of decorum or togetherness for this court?
Because it's easier for everybody. But the truth is that I have never covered a court like this. I've never covered a court with no center. This is a court that has six very, very conservative justices, maybe more conservative as a group than for almost a century even. The middle always sort of kept everybody on with a certain kind of equilibrium, and that doesn't exist anymore. It was Justice O'Connor or Justice Kennedy, and in other eras, it was other people, Justice Souter to some extent, and it's just not that way anymore.
And just back to the rulings themselves, there was another that involved temporary protected status. That's a program created by Congress in 1990 that allows people from countries going through war, natural disaster, or other crises to temporarily and legally live and work in the U.S. It was created at a time where it had bipartisan support. You report that every president, Republican and Democrat, has embraced it since, except for President Trump. So the conservative members of the court, as you mentioned, have now paved the way for the president to end TPS and to begin mass deportations. How did they reach this decision?
Well, they did it two ways. And one way was the conservatives said this statute never gave the power of the courts to intervene in these cases. It gave all the power in the statute to the president and the Department of Homeland Security. The second part, however, is where it got really very vituperous, let's put it that way. The second part was a constitutional challenge. And the Haitians said, look at all the awful things you've said about us, President Trump. We're from an S-hole country. None of these things is true. And that is evidence of racial discrimination. Justice Alito, who wrote both these decisions, said, look, I agree. The language is unfortunate. And some years ago, it would have been considered scandalous, but that's the way the world is today. And we don't think that there's been any discrimination. The other side, Justice Kagan, writing for the dissent, said, what are you talking about? This is classic racist behavior. That's basically what she said.
And so given all this, what are you expecting as the court wraps up next week?
Well, we've got a lot of cases yet to be decided, including birthright citizenship, which if that turns out to be in the same vein as what we saw today, it will surprise a lot of people, me included, and it will cause quite a, I would say, that would cause quite a furor.
Nina, thank you so much. You can read more of her coverage and more about the cases in the Apple News app. In Venezuela, the search for survivors goes on after the country was hit with back-to-back earthquakes. Thousands remain unaccounted for, and the U.S. Geological Survey is forecasting the death toll to likely climb into the thousands. In the capital of Caracas, residents have poured into the streets and open spaces, some in search of loved ones, others because they fear returning to homes with so much structural damage. Reuters spoke to one man whose entire home was destroyed.
La familia, mi esposa, la nieta, estábamos fuera de...
He said that his whole family was out at the time, and luckily his neighbors were able to escape with their lives as well. But many others remain trapped. And as local journalist Ana Vanessa Herrero told the BBC, the country is stretching its resources.
It's a very hard situation for firefighters and for first responders in Venezuela who don't have the tools they need to face this kind of tragedy. They don't have the machinery, so they are now waiting for the international community to come together and enter Venezuela.
The U.S. is among those committed to supporting efforts. Secretary of State Marco Rubio spoke about the situation from the Middle East.
They have a bunch of collapsed buildings, and so they'll need a lot of help in terms of digging through that. The airport there is badly damaged, so we'll have to rely on the Department of War to deploy assets there. And then we're also helping them with some overhead imagery, especially in coastal areas where they don't have full visibility over what the damage has been and what the impact has been.
Venezuela sits on one of the most active tectonic boundaries in South America, but its exact positioning makes quakes of this scale rare. Experts believe the first earthquake, a 7.2 magnitude, triggered the second one, which registered as a 7.5 magnitude. It's called a doublet. And seismologist Adam Pascal explained to CNN how they can be so devastating.
A 7.5 may not seem much larger than 7.2, but it's actually twice as large because of the way the scale works. So it just means that that shaking will have gone on for so much longer. So it's really an unusual and very dangerous sequence of events.
In the days ahead, questions will also turn to why some buildings collapsed and others held firm. Kelvin Padilla lives in one of the worst hit areas, and he spoke to the BBC about what he saw.
Something that I was watching yesterday, and I think this is really important, the houses with maybe two floors is okay, the majority. But the buildings, the really old buildings from 50 years ago, everything crashed, everything. And with people inside, that's crazy.
One engineer told the New York Times that the images emerging suggested that many of the buildings were made of brittle concrete without adequate steel reinforcement, an issue also raised by the U.S. Geological Survey. And one expert told NPR that many buildings around the world were ultimately designed before there was much understanding about engineering for earthquakes. Here are a few other stories we're following today. The controversial alligator Alcatraz facility has officially closed after Florida Governor Ron DeSantis said that it had served its purpose. All detainees have already left, having been moved out in advance of Florida's hurricane season. Miami-Dade County's mayor said that she hopes to sell the land that housed the facility to the National Park Service to incorporate it into environmental restoration projects. The move comes as the Department of Homeland Security Inspector General announced on Thursday that it was investigating treatment of immigrants in facilities operated by ICE. The probe extends back to 2021 and covers the tenures of the past two heads of DHS. The European heat wave smashed temperature records this week, as alerts were raised across the UK, Spain, and elsewhere. France has been the worst hit, experiencing its hottest day ever earlier this week, with a high of 111.7 degrees. Nearly 50 people have drowned, mostly younger victims swimming in unsupervised areas. The heat has become unrelenting in a country without much air conditioning. Some schools have closed, and unions are warning of strikes if more don't follow suit. Yesterday, the French government warned that even young people were at risk of cardiac arrest. The record temperatures have been blamed on a heat dome encompassing parts of the continent, and a senior UN official said that it had, quote, the fingerprints of the climate crisis all over it. And finally, to the World Cup match that neither side wants to win. This weekend, Algeria and Austria face off in Kansas City, but it could be the loser who leaves the happier of the two. That's because whoever wins could clinch runner-up in their group, and that makes it more likely they'll play Spain, the current champions of Europe and a tournament favorite. Now, these quirks can sometimes happen in World Cups, but this year, there's even more potentially unusual scenarios, with 32 teams qualifying for the knockouts rather than 16. So, will they throw the game? Austria, at least, has a cautionary tale in their past they might be thinking about. Back in 1982, they played West Germany in the Spanish city of Gijón. A narrow win for the Germans would have sent both teams through. So after one early goal, both sides effectively gave up. It was so infamous, it became known as the Disgrace of Gijón. Somehow, the Disgrace of Kansas City just wouldn't have the same ring to it. You can find all these stories and more in the Apple News app. And if you're already listening to the News app right now, stick around for the latest episode of Apple News in Conversation. This week, guest host David Greene talks to The New Yorker's J. Caspian Kang about his deep dive into the crisis facing higher education in America today and what the future might look like.
The most fundamental question, and I don't know if the colleges are ready to ask this question, which is like, why are we here? What are we doing? Like, why do we exist, right, outside of a credentialing system that people do because they've done it in the past or because their parents did it or because employers want it?
If you're listening in the podcast app, you can follow Apple News in Conversation to find that episode or just come back to the Apple News Today feed tomorrow. Enjoy the weekend, and I'll be back with the news on Monday.